So welcome to our third in a series of six Soup and Hope presentations. We decided today to have the sun come out so you can finally see the windows of this chapel. But for as prominent as this building is, I'm always amazed when I meet people who have never walked into this space, who know that it's an iconic place but have no idea what it looks like inside. So I won't ask any of you first-timers to out yourselves, but for those who have never been in Sage Chapel, I hope you'll take some time today or come again another time. It opens very early and stays open very late to wander through the space and enjoy its beauty and its history. And if you need a little bit of incentive, let me invite you to consider looking at the stained glass window that you can't see from where you're seated, so you'll have to walk into the transept, which is dedicated to alumnus Michael Schwerner and his friends James Chaney and Andrew Goodman, who were young civil rights workers who were killed while promoting voting registration among African Americans back in 1964. There's also a plaque in the back in the choir dedicated to alumnus E.B. White, who was a member of the Sage Chapel Choir and who wrote, among other things, Charlotte's Web. So if you look for the plaque, you'll also see Charlotte and Wilbur and Templeton. And one of the windows, only one, was done by Louis Tiffany. I'll let you figure out which one that might be. And the last little story, at a recent wedding in which I officiated here, a very distraught grandmother of the bride took great offense at the depiction of Pontius Pilate in the center of the sanctuary. Now, Pilate was a first century Roman prefect and kind of a villainous character in the four of the Christian Gospels. But the people in the mosaic are actually depictions of the disciplines of the university. If you would come close at some point, you'll see they hold an emblem of whatever it was they represented, whether it was music or art or architecture or biology or astronomy. In the very center is the human depiction of philosophy, which was considered for centuries the queen of the sciences, because all other disciplines derived from it. That's why the kind of original doctorate is a doctor of philosophy. All emanates from that, at least philosophers tell me. The grandmother, just to finish the story, was not impressed. As she walked away, she muttered, "If it looks like Pilate and it's in a church, it must be Pilate." So enough of that. I hope that draws you into the space. Today's servers all come from University Relations, where today's featured speaker has worked. They are Penny Given and Caitlin Brill from Community Relations, Gina Giambattista and Pamela Hampton from the Office of the Assemblies, and Gary Frank from Strategic Communications. So thanks to all of you for the service that you're offering us today. Now, let me invite Karen Yearwood, who will introduce today's Soup and Hope speaker.
Thank you. I've known Cal Walker for almost 11 years. Cal was the co-founder and first executive director at Village at Ithaca. I succeeded Cal as executive director at Village at Ithaca 4.5 years ago. And Village at Ithaca has been in this community for 17 years. Ithaca has been Cal's home for 40 plus years. 15 years he worked as a sales rep at Procter & Gamble, and for 25 years he worked at Cornell University in the Learning Strategy Center and Community Relations. He and his wife Glenda have 3 biological children and have fostered 49 children in 63 different placements. So you think 3 is enough, and then you have 49, you must love it. Several of these children are now adults, some with families of their own, and they have lasting love and relationship with the Walkers. Cal has been a tutor within Ithaca for 26 plus years. He never gives up on a student. He's an engaging tutor who connects well with his student. He's well respected, and with the Ithaca City School District, he's the go-to alternate instructor. And then just to share a story about Cal and his students, there was one student that resided in the West Hill area who had injured himself and needed alternate instruction, and he was on crutches. He made his way down from West Hill to the Village at Ithaca office downtown because he wanted to work with Cal. He was so committed because Cal was such an engaging, inspiring individual within this young man's life. There was another student, a female, that would come to our office occasionally, and Cal worked with her and with the rigor of the academics and reviewing work with her. And then one day she just threw her hand down on the desk and said, "Why can't you just allow me to fail in peace?" But with Cal, he always said to every one of his students, failure is not an option. When you ask people, which I did, I became the roving reporter when Cal had asked me to talk on his behalf and introduce him. I went around and just asked people, well, when you hear the name Cal Walker, what do you think of? Someone said he's a wonderful person. He connects with children of all ages. He's a role model, an educator, a mentor, a family man. He has a giving heart. He's helped our family for generations. He's part of a singing group, the John Simon and Cal Walker group, a little kid had reminded us. And he's such an encourager. When I asked Cal about how is he enjoying life now, what is his life motto? He said that he's stress-free and serene. And he said it in such a nice, calm voice, too, that makes you want to be serene and join in with him. He lives daily with the attitude of gratitude. A few years ago, Cal spoke at the Ithaca Rotary downtown, and it was after he had celebrated his birthday, and he told the guests and the Rotarians there that I hope to see more years until I'm 91 plus years old. Just to tell you a secret, which is not a secret at this point, yesterday was Cal's birthday. As we welcome Cal Walker here to give his hope and inspiration, let's join in and sing in happy birthday to Cal.
Happy birthday.
Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. Thank you all. Thank you. Oh my goodness. Wow, you all are all full of surprises today. That's fantastic. Thank you so very much. Karen, thank you very much for that introduction. Thank you to the Soup and Hope Committee for your thoughtfulness and generosity in presenting this birthday present. Thank all of you for coming out today. I'm deeply honored to be invited back as a Soup and Hope speaker. And I say back because I was also honored to be a speaker during the first year, some roughly 10 years ago. And here's what I can promise you. If you were here then, I will definitely share something different today. And the reason I can guarantee that is I have absolutely no recollection whatsoever of what I said 10 years ago. So it has to be different, right? Soup and Hope. There was a recent article in the Cornell Sun about this series, and there was a line that read, "Soup and Hope series touches on the universal experience of being human." And certainly that's something that we can all relate to. And there was a quote from that article by Jennifer Austin on the planning committee, who said this, "Soup and Hope talks call upon a different strength. They focus on the ability of someone to speak openly about the ways in which they have personally wrestled with and sought meaning from the struggles and challenges of life." Struggles and challenges of life. You know, I've had some of those. And it's my guess that many of you, if not all of you, have had some as well. And so when going through a struggle, I often remind myself of those words of Frederick Douglass that says, where there is no struggle, there is no progress. Now, while that may not necessarily lessen the severity of the particular struggle, it does, for me, adjust my perspective about that struggle. Often during life struggles, we stand in the greatest need of a sustaining hope, hope of a breakthrough, hope that we will get through this struggle. And that is what I want to share with you today, the struggle of a personal challenge that may well have been the toughest that I've ever faced, quite frankly, and the hope that brought me through it and, in fact, has me here before you today. So what is hope? We often talk about hopes and dreams and aspirations. We talk about hope as an optimistic state of mind based on an expectation of a positive outcome regarding the events and circumstances of our personal lives, family, career, relationships, or for that matter, in the world at large, when we talk about hope for eventual world peace. Now, there is, of course, a very significant difference between wishing and hoping. Simple wishing tends to be more passive. I often share the quote, a goal without a concrete plan of action is only a wish. For me, hoping is more proactive, catalyzed by our way of being and our purposeful actions in support of that that we hope for. I often hear the phrase, well, hope is not a strategy. And I said, okay. But here's my response. That depends. Okay, all this popping, I got to figure out how not to do this. Okay? All right. So my response to the saying that hope is not a strategy is that it simply depends on what anchors that hope, what gives that hope root. Let me make this personal. As Karen has mentioned, I've been in Ithaca for over 40 years, roughly 43. And Glenda, my wife, years ago had this t-shirt made for me, well, not a t-shirt, but a long sleeve shirt, with Community Cal on the front. And it had emblems of various representations of the types of things that I was involved with here in this community. I have always had an activist bent, an activist orientation from really my early teenage years. And that activism was shaped by a sense of social responsibility and being an active community citizen committed to making a positive difference when and wherever I can. And in so doing, my hope has always been that mine, that our community becomes a better place to live, in part simply because I live here, and that I am consistently committed to working progressively toward that end. Since moving to Ithaca almost 43 years ago, that hope has led to various specific actions, among them serving on a wide range of action-oriented boards and committees, teaching life skills classes at the local jail for over a decade, as Karen mentioned, having fostered almost 50 children, promoting positive personal development in our young people through tutoring, through mentoring, through advocacy, through early literacy promotion and various other means. So for me, hope is active. Now, to the struggle that I alluded to earlier. I became critically ill 4 years ago. In fact, just recently I transitioned from long-term disability to retirement after 25 years here at Cornell. And so I want to share my experience of hope. It was a hope that was anchored in faith that led to a greater peace and a much clearer sense of purpose. I haven't figured out the popping thing yet. Y'all notice that, right? Okay. You know, I mean, because see, sometimes stuff is just so obvious, you may as well just say it, right? Because I'm doing it again. Okay, we're going to get this right. So I want to give you a synopsis of that journey, that illness that began mid-December 2014. Now, I'm backing up a little bit. Can you hear me all the way in the back? You good? Okay, great. So I became suddenly symptomatic literally overnight. I went to bed that mid-December Friday night feeling great. I got up that Saturday morning so overcome with fatigue, I couldn't walk from my bed to the bathroom. It was an extreme fatigue. It was unlike any fatigue I had ever experienced. And I was a really good athlete in high school in Syracuse and played football. And I remember those double sessions we used to have in the late summer, sweltering heat in preparation for the start of the season in the fall, and doing those double sessions and just being so tired. The fatigue I felt that morning was unlike that. It was an over-the-top kind of fatigue. I spent the entire weekend in bed thinking that I just needed to rest, although I had no idea why I was so tired. And just thinking that maybe all of my regular community cal activity was finally catching up with me. And my mother used to always say, you need to take time to rest. You don't rest enough, you're always doing. And then she was going to say, even God took a Sabbath day. And so I got through that weekend, and then first thing that Monday morning, I went to the doctor for a sick visit, had various blood tests and other diagnostics, went back home to bed again for the better part of the next few days, and then went to the hospital for some outpatient diagnostic scans ordered by my doctor. Then I went back home, repeated the cycle of bed rest, absolutely no relief from the overwhelming fatigue. Another doctor visit exactly 1 week later, my weight had dropped from 180 to 159 pounds. I lost 21 pounds in a 7-day period. I was admitted to the hospital. By now I'm on short-term disability for my work in community relations in Day Hall. And over a period of a couple weeks, 7 different medical specialists examined me and prescribed various tests, various scans, various labs. I had more medical testing done in that period, that concentrated period, that I had had in my entire life. And at that time, I was 61. Here's the weird thing about that. All these different diagnostic tests, all these bloods, one place drew 29 tubes of blood. All these tests they did came back in the normal ranges. Doctors called it a medical anomaly. So now, over 3 weeks, still no diagnosis, consequently, no treatment. Tests, more tests, couple biopsies, consultations with major medical centers, and talk of possible transfer to Baltimore, Boston, or New York City. Meanwhile, I was getting sicker and sicker. Now, I didn't know a lot about biology, physiology, or medical science in general, but here's what I did know. What's happening to me is simply not sustainable. A hospital chaplain, someone that I had known quite well, Tim Dean, from involvement with the local faith community, was in to visit me one day, and still no diagnosis. He said, Cal, I just sense in my spirit that this interruption may lead to a great invitation. I found it very profound, and also came to find it very prophetic. So as you can imagine, this was a really stressful time for my family, near and far, immediate family, extended family. And I got a lot of them. I had a lot of cousins. I mean, at one point I counted, I had like 89 cousins, right? And I'm serious. My mother was one of 12, and I had a whole lot of family, right? And so they were, family and friends were very anxious for answers. People were checking in daily. Do the doctors know what's wrong yet? Do they have a diagnosis? Some of my children live out of town. All of them had been to see me, and obviously they were all worried. They'd never really seen me sick before, and this was not an encouraging sight. And so understandably, they were feeling scared, they were feeling hopeless, and to allay their fears, I said, look, I'm going to be fine. I'm community cal. I'm going to be fine. And I told them that. And I told them that only for their benefit, because I got to tell you that there was absolutely no indication whatsoever that I would be fine. Things looked and felt pretty bleak. And so for background, it's important for you to know that I was born in Montgomery, Alabama, 1954. I grew up in Tuskegee. And like most Southern Black families, I was heavily steeped in a very strong faith tradition. It was our anchor then, it is now, and will always continue to be. And as I lay in that hospital bed for what seemed like days on end, my faith had grown noticeably weaker. So in the still of a long and restless night, early in January of 2015, I had a candid talk with God that went something like this. I'm getting all this medical attention. I've got half a dozen doctors that can't figure out what's going on with me. I know this cannot go on indefinitely. I have promised my children that I'm going to be all right, and unless there is a miracle, I simply can't see how I'm going to survive, and I need to keep that promise. So God, I need to hear from you. And this was unmistakably God's response, which I heard clear as a bell, and that I think about almost daily. And this is what it was. This sickness is not unto death. You shall not die, but live and declare the works of the Lord. Now, this causes me to tear up every time I share it. And over the last 4 years, I've shared a lot, so y'all just got to deal with it. So I immediately recognized those two things as scripture passages, one from the Gospel of John, the other from the Book of Psalms. And I can tell you that at that very moment, the hope that had been failing was activated and elevated. That was my breakthrough moment. I went from doubting that I could survive to knowing that I would. I was at peace, even in the midst of what had been several troubling weeks of uncertainty. And still, there was no diagnosis. Until about 24 hours later, when the doctor came in with the biopsy results, a very grim look on his face and said, Mr. Walker, there's a definitive diagnosis, it's lymphoma. He told me the specific type of cancer, and it was one that's on the rare end of the spectrum. And it's amazing to me how, I've learned that there's just so many different kinds of cancer. This is one of the rare types. And so when he said that, here's what I said. I said, I'm glad y'all finally figured this out. And I said it with a sense of calm, and there was absolutely no visceral reaction at all. And I remember the doctor. I remember him well. In fact, one of the other doctors said, this particular doctor saved your life, because he was the one who ordered that particular biopsy. And so when he said that, when I said, I'm glad that y'all have figured this out, very emotionless, really, he said, Mr. Walker, do you know what a lymphoma is? I said, yeah, I know it's a type of cancer, but other than that, I don't know anything about it. There's not a history of cancer in my family, and, to my knowledge, I don't really know anybody very close to me that has experienced a very serious, experienced a particular kind of cancer. And so this is what he said. He said, would you like for me to call someone? Very subdued, very supportive voice. Call your spouse, call the chaplain. Okay, now the noise y'all hear now is not me, all right? I just want y'all to know. I said, no, it's not necessary for you to call anybody. I'll call my wife a little bit later, but thank you. He had a quizzical look on his face, and he said, are you sure? I said, yeah, I'm fine. Just glad that there's a diagnosis, because now I can be treated and not just examined over and over. And so as I looked at his countenance, the doctor was visibly processing what must have seemed a rather muted reaction on my part. Then he went on to explain that an oncologist had been called and would be coming over to consult with me about next immediate steps. Now, meanwhile, the nurse who was in the room when the doctor came in to give me the biopsy results had gone out, and she returned with a printed document, kind of a medical fact sheet, on this particular disease, this particular type of lymphoma. And there were several pages with this message printed prominently on page one. I still got this document at home. It said, without immediate treatment, survival for this particular type of lymphoma is normally a few short weeks. I was in week four. So I used to tell people, when I tell the story, I said, you know, I was getting sicker and I was getting progressively sicker. And then once I understood the nature of the disease, what I realized is I was progressively dying. I was at week four, and the prognosis was that without that particular biopsy, wouldn't have been a week five. So, although that was a very sobering document to read, you got to remember that for me, everything had already shifted. It was sobering news, but I mean, I remember just like it was yesterday, even though it was 4 years ago, there was no doubt, there was no fear, there was just anticipation about what's the treatment going to be like? When is it going to get started? Where am I going to have to go? And then I realized, oh, okay, you got to tell your family about this. And I knew that, you know, telling somebody that you got a cancer diagnosis, particularly when you got to tell them what kind it is, and I knew they were going to immediately go and Google it. And then I got to remember, they have seen me wasting away. And despite the absolute certainty of the revelation that I know I had already received, I know my family, and they weren't ready to process that in the same way that I was. I knew it would be difficult telling my children they'd be on the telephone, and despite any assurance that I tried to give them, I knew that was going to be a tough conversation. My wife, Glenda, struggled big time. She didn't understand how I could possibly be so nonchalant about what she felt like, what felt to her like a bombshell. I remember one day over dinner, she said, Cal, are you in denial? And I, honest to God, I'm sitting there and said, okay, denial. It wasn't immediately clear to me what she was talking about. I mean, it really wasn't. I'm serious. And then she said, well, you have a cancer disease that, according to the information you've shared, kills most people. And you act like you got a headache. I grew up with cluster migraines, and Excedrin was my friend. She said, you can't take Excedrin for this. And, you know, so, but again, when you know that you know that you know, all the other stuff doesn't matter. I don't know a lot about medicine, but I knew that the sickness is not unto death. I shall not die, but live and declare the works of the Lord. That's all I need to know. And because of the severity of that disease, my treatment started immediately. They implanted a port. Still got that port at home, as a matter of fact, when they finally took it out. They started the first of many chemo cycles, which was a combination of five chemo drugs that were the most potent that they could administer. And in fact, they told me at the chemo facility, there is nobody else that comes here anytime that gets what you're getting. I said, okay. Right? That's part of the treatment. Let's get it on, right? Chemo can be really brutal to the body. I've seen it in others during my treatments at the local infusion center. And I saw it with a very close cousin of mine, my cousin Janice. Janice and I are exactly the same age. Janice was living in Columbus, Ohio, and we were simultaneously being treated for cancer. And we would check in with each other after each major treatment phase. And Janice told me one day, she said, cuz, I can't do this anymore. And she said, I'm going to stop the chemo. And she knew that it would probably hasten her death. And sadly, it did. And I remember making four trips to Columbus during that time. And I was able to be there when Janice died. So, despite the potency of my treatments, and they were ultra potent, You talk about an anomaly? I had absolutely no side effects. No vomiting, no nausea, no diarrhea. Despite the fact that my treatments were very concentrated, it was 5 consecutive days every 3 weeks for 5 months. And day one of my chemo infusions lasted 4 to 5 hours. Remember, the most potent combination of 5 chemo drugs that they could administer, and nobody else in the facility was getting it. And for the first half of those treatments, for the first 2.5 months, I go get chemo treatments, come home and rake the leaves, feel like mowing the lawn. I'm serious. I mean, it was crazy to me, given all of what I had heard about chemo and seeing folks coming into the infusion labs as often as I did and just seeing how just beating them up and thinking about my cousin. And I'm thinking that this, everything about my situation was anomalous. From the time it took to figure out the diagnosis to all those tests and scans that were coming back in the normal ranges to me having no perceptible side effects whatsoever. So rather than dreading the treatments, I came to look at it as a fascinating learning experience. I asked a lot of questions, found myself being somewhat intrigued. And I need to say that I know that that's not the norm for people. You may have loved ones or you may know somebody who's been through chemo. And I've recognized that my experience is very atypical. That stuff is poison. It can do a lot of damage. But for some almost inexplicable reason, I didn't have any of that. And as I said, I was literally 2.5 months into a 5-month cycle before I even began to feel any manifestation of it all, and that was a little bit of fatigue. So let me hasten on here. After a 2-month period for my body to heal, I spent a couple months at Roswell Park Cancer Institute in Buffalo for phase 2 of treatments, and that was a bone marrow stem cell transplant. They told me when they diagnosed the disease, phase 1 is not going to help you a lot. I mean, it's going to help you, but it's only going to prepare you for phase 2. You got to do phase 2. And phase 2 was moving to Buffalo and doing the stem cell transplant. This is how they explained it to me. They said, we're going to copy your immune system. We're going to totally then wipe it out. Then we're going to transplant stem cells back into your body. And oh, by the way, after several months, you got to start getting all of your childhood inoculations over again, which was amazing to me. I found it fascinating. I still find it fascinating. Because when I started that process, which I have now finished, I was getting the same or very similar shots as my little grandkids. And I was by then like 63. So I thought it was pretty amazing. I want to fast forward. Right now I'm doing well. I'm doing very well. The lingering effects from the transplant have been severe chronic fatigue, but that's gotten a lot better. I finished all the inoculations and I'm doing fine. Shortly after finishing the treatments and returning to Ithaca, a very close friend and neighbor who had been a major support to me and my family throughout that whole process, shared something with me that he said he wouldn't dare share before. This is what he shared. He said, after learning of my diagnosis a year earlier, he called a physician friend of his in Houston, Texas, and the physician told him, I wish I had better news, but with that particular diagnosis, it would be a miracle if your friend survives. And then just 4 weeks ago, as a matter of fact, right down at the Wegmans up in the upstairs, I was with a couple folks, one of whom is a good friend of mine, a scientist at the vet school, and this is what he told me. He said, Cal, everybody that I have known that had what you had died. You are the only one that survived. So, folks, that was kind of an abbreviated story of my journey through a major struggle and the hope, activated and catalyzed by an unshakable faith, brought me through it. And with the onset of the illness, my community Cal activities came to a screeching halt. That pause gave me an opportunity really what I call a gift of time to reset priorities as necessary to decide which activities I wanted to resume, which new ones I wanted to embrace. Earlier I mentioned the hospital chaplain saying this interruption of my illness could possibly lead to a great invitation. Well, among those invitations have been that I'm now investing more time tutoring and mentoring students, something that I've done fairly consistently over the last 25 years. I've ratcheted up a notch. I'm becoming active with the board of directors at the free science workshop over on Hancock Street, a creative exploration and discovery for young people in the North Side area. And here's the interesting thing. Science had always been, for me, by far my least favorite subject. I didn't like it. I didn't understand it. But after going through what I did and getting an appreciation of the science involved and stuff, that has completely changed. I have just a voracious appetite now for science, particularly for medical science. In terms of another invitation, over the years I've bought books. I tell people I buy books by the dozen, but I read them by the chapter. So now instead of, you know, taking months to read a book, I finish books in days. And it's great because I got like 5 bookshelves at home, all the stuff that I bought over the years and buying more all the time. So that's one of the benefits of the gift of time, one of the invitations that I now have. I've also been wanting to write a book or two for several years now, and I'm very happy to report that I'm now actively beginning a pursuit of doing that. Other thing is, look, I'm 64, well, just turned 65 yesterday. I am learning to swim. I have not been able to swim all my life. I got to the point where I was scared of water, and I took showers and baths, but got to the point where I can't do it. I don't want to do it. I can't stand water getting up my nose and my ears and my eyes. No, can't do that. I'm swimming now, and I want to tell y'all that I have the most phenomenal swimming coach, encourager, Mr. Shane Eversfield. I know Shane is here. If you ever want to learn how to swim, Shane's right there. The amazing, amazing Shane Eversfield. So I'm learning to swim. Did some else that I was always scared to do. Never really liked snakes down at the Free Science Workshop. I went in one day and just held the python. Now some of y'all who are my Facebook friends probably saw me on Facebook holding this python. I can't tell you the number of email posts I got and messages from people saying, look, when you had that transplant, they probably took out your brain. Because holding a python don't make no kind of sense. And the other thing is I'm walking now. I'm not Cal Walker for nothing. I've always liked to walk. And one of the things that I wanted to do was like log at least 1,000 miles a year of walking. And I'm very happy to say that I looked at my app at the end of 2016 on December 31st, and I had averaged for the year 3.4 miles per day. And if you do the math, that's like 1,200 miles. So this year it's going to be at least 4 miles a day that I'm walking. So I'm going to finish up. In closing, I want to share some wisdom from one of your favorite philosophers and mine, Snoopy. So somebody just sent me this the other day. It was a picture of Charlie Brown and Snoopy sitting kind of overlooking a beach or something. And Charlie Brown says to Snoopy, "We only live once, Snoopy." Snoopy said, "Wrong. We only die once. We live every day." And so my hope is that you will live each day to the fullest, that no matter what you're going through, there's still something in your life for which you can be grateful. There's an old saying that says, yesterday is history, tomorrow's a mystery, but today is a gift. And that's why it's called the present. So if time permits, I'm happy to take a question or two. If not, you can call me at 607-227-8725 or email me at cdw2@cornell.edu. I have my personal business cards in my pocket, and I'll be happy to give you one if you want to call me later. What I can tell you is that this has been a lot of fun. Thank you all for coming out, and go out and make it a great rest of the day.